and what he had endured. When Caden woke, he awkwardly stood, his hand skimming his bare chest, and he said hello to Birdie and Gwyneth. Birdie frowned, her hands on her hips.
"Well, you got all kinds of surprises in you, don't you, pelt trader?"
"I suppose I have a few," he answered, a slight blush tinging his temples. Gwyneth snorted.
"Not the least of which is delivering babies."
Caden turned, looking at Pauline.
"How is he?"
"Fine," she answered quietly. He walked over, a smile pulling at the corner of his mouth, and gently nudged the blanket aside so he could see the baby's face. Pauline leaned back, lifting the baby protectively to her chest. Caden noticed her retreat, and his smile disappeared. He stepped away, a small movement that stung with disappointment, and my heart ached for him. But I understood Pauline, too. After all she had been through, trust was as slippery as hope.
"Anything else you plan to surprise us with?"
Birdie asked. He looked at me.
"Leah, I need to speak with you privately."
"Not so fast, soldier," Gwyneth intervened. "Anything you have to say to her, you can tell us all."
I nodded. At some point, we all had to start trusting one another. He shrugged.
"Have it your way. I know another one of your traitors. My father is no longer Lord of County Dewar. He sits on the king's cabinet."
Pauline drew in a sharp breath. Caden didn't have to say a name. It was immediately apparent to her, much as it was to me. There was no one else in the cabinet with Caden's white blonde hair or his warm brown eyes. Even the sound of his calm, steady voice was the same. Everything that should have been obvious had eluded us, and I realized there were assumptions we made about people, and once we did, that was all we could see. Caden was a barbarian assassin, the vice-regent a respected lord descended from the Holy Guardians, and surely one could have nothing in common with the other. Birdie and Gwyneth didn't know the vice-regent and remained silent, but Caden glanced from me to Pauline, wondering at her reaction.
"Lord Rocher," he added to confirm his assertion.
For a moment I planned to lie to him, say there was no Lord Rocher in the cabinet, afraid that he would storm off and get his head bashed in again. But he was already reading my eyes.
"Don't lie to me, Leah."
I braced myself, knowing he wouldn't take this well.
"I know who he is. I met with him 2 days ago. He's a member of the cabinet, as you said. He may have been a terrible father, Caden, but there's no proof he's a traitor."
Chapter 54.
I had watched Caden stomp toward the mill to check on the animals. I could almost see the steam rising from his shoulders.
"It's a lie. I have no relatives. My mother was an only child. The people who took me in were professional beggars."
I saw the rage in his face, but I also remembered the genuine grief in the vice-regent's eyes.
He was only 8, a grieving child who had just lost his mother.
If there was one thing I had learned, it was that time could twist and shred truth like a forgotten sheet battered in the wind. Now I had to piece the shreds together again. I told Natia I had another job for the priest, and at the first break in the weather, she was to go to him. A record of trained governesses was kept in the archives. Somewhere, there had to be some information on one named Catherine. Diechi's ears twitched with satisfaction as I scratched between them. I gave Nove equal affection, and wondered if they missed Otto. The mill was dry, but one wall had tumbled away long ago, leaving the old building cold and drafty. Owls roosted in the high rafters. Natia sat in a far corner, drawing a whetstone over her sword. We had sparred this morning. She was the one who had reminded me of the need to keep our skills sharp. The habits I had taught her across the Camlan Toe remained deeply ingrained. Pauline had watched with what I thought was a doubtful eye, and later questioned me again about the Komazar's army.
"They're going to destroy Morrigan," I said, "and traitors here are going to help them do it. We have to be ready."
"But Leah," she shrugged, her expression full of skepticism.
"That's impossible. We are the favored remnant. The gods have ordained it. Morrigan is too great to fall."
I looked at her, not sure what to say, not wanting to shake her world further, but I had no choice.
"No," I said, "we aren't too great. No kingdom is too great to fall."
"But the holy text says..."
"There are other truths, Pauline, ones you need to know."
And I told her about Gudrell, Venda, and the girl Morrigan, who was stolen from her family and sold to Aldred the Scavenger for a sack of grain. I told her about the histories we never knew, and the thieves and scavengers who were the bricks and mortar of our kingdom, not a chosen remnant. The holy guardians were not holy at all. Saying it aloud to her felt cruel, like I had snatched a cherished piece of crystal from her hand and smashed it beneath my foot. But it had to be said. She stood, dazed, walking around the cottage, trying to absorb this news. I saw her mind ticking through texts. She whirled.
"And how do you know the histories you found are true?"
"I don't. And that's the hardest part. But I know there are truths that have been hidden from us, Pauline. Ones we each have to find with our own hearts. Truth is as free as the air, and we all have the right to breathe as deeply of it as we wish. It cannot be held back in the palm of any one man." She turned away and stared into the loft where the owls roosted. With each shake of her head, I knew she was trying to dismiss it, weighing my truths against the only other truth she had ever known, the Morrigee's holy text. Scavengers. If it was true, this history robbed us of our elevated status among kingdoms. As I watched her, I understood with clarity why the royal scholar had hidden Gudrell's history away. It undermined who we were. What I didn't understand was why he hadn't just destroyed it. Someone had tried to once. Pauline took a deep breath and wiped her hands on her skirt, smoothing it out.
"I have to get back to the cottage," she said. "It's time for the baby's feeding."
Chapter 55. Pauline.
During the night, after feeding the baby, I had lain on my side for a long while, watching Caden sleep, still wondering at his scars. Now when he looked in a mirror, he would see another mark, the one I had left, alongside the ones his father had laid. Back in Terravin, a simple shirt and a few kind words had covered up everything about who I had believed he was. Mikhail had done the same, but he covered up his true nature with a few flowery words. I let those words wheedle into me until they were all I saw. Was it possible to ever really know anyone? Or was I simply the worst judge of character in all of history? I rolled over, looking at the shadows flickering on the ceiling. His seeing my lady parts was the least of my distress. I was still haunted by his expression when he first held the baby in his hands. That seemed real. His eyes were filled with wonderment. But then as he reached out and laid the baby on my chest, he faltered, as if he already knew I would never allow this child in his arms again. One part of me knew I needed to thank him for helping me. But another part was still angry, and a greater part, afraid. How could I be sure if any of his kindness was real this time? What if he was still using us for another purpose the way he had before? I knew Leah trusted him. That should have been enough for me. But trust was out of my reach. I knelt on the porch, scrubbing the crate he had found in the mill.
"It might make a passable cradle for now,"
he had said when he offered it to me this morning. He hadn't met my gaze. He just set it on the porch and walked away. He was almost out of earshot before I called after him. When he turned, I said, "Thank you." He stood there, studying me, then finally nodded and left. It had poured for 4 days straight, rivers of water rushing down hillsides, more leaks sprouting in the cottage roof. I wasn't sure if the deluge had been blessing or curse, trapping us in such small quarters. But it also forced Leah and Caden to work out the argument between them. Caden wanted to go to the vice-regent himself, confront him. Leah said no, not until the time was right. I was surprised that he listened to her at all. There was a strange bond between them that I still didn't understand. But when she implied there was the possibility that the vice-regent had changed, that 11 years could change a man, and she pointed to Enzo as proof, Caden became incensed. I got a glimpse of the assassin he had been. Maybe the assassin he still was, and I understood that when he said confront, he didn't mean talk.
"People don't change that much,"
he yelled and stormed out into the rain. He returned an hour later, soaked, and they didn't speak of it again. I had said myself that people didn't change, but I pondered the possibility. Leah had changed. She had always been fearless, oblivious to threat when something rankled her greatly, impulsive sometimes at cost to herself. But I saw a calculating, colder steel in her now that hadn't been there before. She had suffered. All my months of worry for her well-being weren't unfounded. She tried to brush past details, but I saw the scars where arrows had pierced her back and thigh. She had nearly died. I saw the thin line on her cheekbone where the Commissar had beat her. But there were other scars that couldn't be seen on her skin. Those were the ones I worried about. A vacant stare, a curled fist, a defiant lip twisted at some memory. Deeper scars from seeing people she loved murdered, and knowing more had died after her escape. I saw that she cared about the Venden people. She often spoke in their language with Caden, and her remembrances included their traditions as well. "Are you one of them now, Leah?" I had asked her. She looked at me, surprised at first, but then some memory flickered in her eyes, and she didn't answer. Maybe she wasn't sure herself. It was her remembrances that had changed the most. She didn't say them by grudging obligation anymore, but with a zealous power that stilled the air, calling up not just the gods, but it seemed the stars and generations too. A fullness grew in the air as if the breaths of the world kept time with our own. And I saw her stare into the darkness, her eyes focused on something the rest of us couldn't see. She didn't fear the gift any longer, but embraced it. She coaxed, demanded, trusted. She spoke of the gift in ways I had never heard before, its ways of seeing and knowing and trusting, ways that made me reach deeper inside myself. I had seen a glimpse of her brokenness, too. She hid it well, but when Natia began describing to Birdie and Gwyneth what the Dalbrick army and outpost were like, and she merely mentioned Rafe's name, Leah walked out onto the porch as if she couldn't bear to listen. I followed and found her leaning against a post, watching the downpour. "She seems fascinated with the Dalbrick army," I said. "She's very young to be carrying all those weapons. I didn't think vagabonds..." "They don't carry weapons," Leah said. "Natia tried to help me by sewing a knife into the hem of my cloak. Her camp paid dearly for it. And now she wants justice."
The very people she had welcomed into her camp betrayed her. Her way of life and her innocence have been robbed. One she may get back, the other never.
I tried to gently nudge the conversation. She thinks highly of the King of Dalbrek. Leah didn't respond. What happened between you two? I asked. Her cheekbone glowed with light from the cottage window, and she faintly shook her head.
Whatever happened was for the best.
I touched her shoulder, and her gaze met mine. The best wasn't what I saw in her eyes. Leah, it's me, Pauline. Tell me, I said softly.
Leave it, please.
She tried to turn away, and I grabbed her arms. I will not. Pretending you aren't hurting won't make the pain disappear.
I can't,
she said. Her voice was hoarse. Her eyes puddled, and she angrily swiped at her lashes.
I can't think about him,
she said more firmly.
There's too much at stake, including his life. I can't afford distractions.
And that's all he was? A distraction?
Surely, you of all people know these things don't always work out.
Leah, I said firmly, and I waited. She closed her eyes.
I needed him, but so did his kingdom. That is a reality that neither of us can change.
But?
I thought he'd come, she whispered. Against all reason. I knew he couldn't. He shouldn't even. But I still found myself looking over my shoulder, thinking he would change his mind. We loved each other. We made vows. We swore that kingdoms and conspiracies wouldn't come between us. But they did.
Tell me everything from the beginning. Tell me the way I told you about Mikhail. We talked for hours. She told me things she hadn't shared before, the moment she first realized who he really was, the tense minutes before they crossed into Venda, the note he had carried in his vest all those months, the way she'd had to pretend to loathe him when all she wanted was to hold him, his promise for a new beginning, the way his voice kept her pinned to this world when she felt herself slipping into another. And then their bitter argument on parting. When I left him behind, I marked every day between us by writing his last words to me in the soil. It's for the best. Until I finally believed them to be true. Then I found my wedding dress, where he had hidden it in the loft at the inn, and it tore everything loose inside of me all over again. How many times do I have to let go, Pauline? I looked at her, unsure of how to answer. Even after everything Mikhail had done, every day I had to let go again. He was a habit in my thoughts, not any more welcome than a rash, but I'd find myself thinking of him before I even realized what I was doing. Banishing him from my thoughts was like learning to breathe in a new way. It was a conscious effort. I don't know, Leah, I had answered her. But however long it takes, I will be here for you. I sat back and looked at the crate. The wood was smooth and sturdy. I stood and hung it from the porch rafter to dry. Yes, Caden is right. Once a soft blanket is added, it will be quite passable.
A scream splits the air. The Pachigos have captured something. The children cry. The darkness too deep. Their stomachs too empty. The howls of the Pachigo too close. Shh, I whisper. Tell them a story, Jafir pleads. Tell them a story of before. but before was never mine to know. I search my memory for Amma's words, the hope, the journey's end, and I desperately add my own words to them. Gather close, children, and I will tell you a story of before. Before the world was brown and barren, when it was still a spinning blue jewel and sparkling towers touched the stars. The scavengers around me scoff, but not Jaffir. He is as starved for a story as the children. The Lost Words of Morrigan. Chapter 56, Rafe.
She's holed up in a little cottage not far from the citadel with three women and Caden. A vagabond girl, too, Davish said. You disobeyed orders. Jeb grinned. You knew we would. And you're glad we did, Oren added. What are those for? Jeb asked, nodding toward the handler and three caged Valspri. In case things don't go well for us. A parting gift from General Draeger. He insisted on them. He doesn't want us to fall off the edge of the continent again without any word. Tavish surveyed the details of our company with a suspicious eye and turned to Captain Azia, perhaps figuring he'd get more information out of him. How'd you get so many horses with Moragi's tack? Sven cleared his throat, preempting an answer from Azia. I knew the question created as sour a taste on his tongue as it did mine. It's a long story, he answered. I'll explain later, I told Tavish. Ride back and tell the rest it's time to split off to the eastern and northern roads into the city, and to stay in groups of no more than three or four. We can't all descend into the city at once. We were farmers, merchants, tradesmen, not a battalion of 100 armed soldiers. At least, that was what we wanted them to think.
Chapter 57.
Heave. Heave. I threw off my blanket and sat up, my skin hot and cold all at once. The synchronized chants, the squeal of gears, the sickening metallic clang still rang in my ears. I looked around, reassuring myself that I was still in the cottage. It was dark and silent except for Birdie's gentle snores. Only a dream, I told myself, and lay down, struggling to get back to sleep. I finally dozed in the pre-dawn hours, then slept late. But when I finally woke, I knew. The sounds and chants were real. The bridge was fixed. They were coming. I looked around. The cottage was empty, except for Gwyneth dozing in the rocker with the baby in her arms. I noticed that the melody of drips falling into buckets and bowls had stopped at last. Finally, I could slip back into town. The streets would be busy again, and I could pass unnoticed. And Bryn and Regan could be back. I quietly dressed, putting on my protective riding leathers and strapping on every weapon I had. If all went well, I might be leading my brothers and their comrades into Aldred Hall by this afternoon. First, I'd scour the citadel one last time for evidence, but with the bridge fixed, confronting the cabinet couldn't wait any longer. I threw on my cloak and tiptoed quietly outside to find the others. I found Pauline at the end of the porch, lifting a crate and hanging it from a nail on a porch timber. Are you sure you should be doing that? I had a baby, Leah, not an accident. I'm actually feeling quite well. First time I haven't had a foot pressing on my bladder in weeks. Besides, cleaning a crate is easy enough work. Caden got it for me from the mill. He just went back over there to let out the animals. The oats are gone. They need to graze. I hoped that was all he was doing. I knew he still wanted to confront his father. I looked around, walking to the other end of the porch. What about Birdie and Natia? Where are they? They went to town while there was a break in the weather for more supplies. She ran her hand along one side of the crate. It will make a decent enough cradle for now, at least when there aren't arms to hold the baby. It seems there will always be plenty of those available. Gwyneth has hardly let the baby out of her grip. Pauline sighed.
I noticed. I hope it's not painful for her. I'm sure it stirs memories in her of all the times she didn't get to hold her own baby.
She told you? I asked, surprised that Gwyneth had shared what I'd thought was a closely guarded secret. I had only guessed because I'd seen the way she looked at Simone back in Terravin. A tenderness had sprung to her face that she had for no one else.
About Simone? Pauline shook her head.
No, she refuses to talk about it. She loves that little girl more than air itself, but at the same time, that love is what grips her with fear. I think that's why she keeps her distance.
Fear of what?
She desperately doesn't want the father to find out that Simone even exists. He's not a good man.
She told you who he was?
Not exactly, but Gwyneth and I have found this strange place of truth. There's a lot that we share without ever saying a word.
She untied her damp apron and hung it to dry beside the crate.
The Chancellor is Simone's father. My jaw dropped. I knew Gwyneth had some unsavory connections, but I never suspected one of them to be so high in the food chain. She had good reason to be afraid. I turned, cursing in Venden to spare Pauline's ears and a penance.
You can curse in Morghese, she said. No penance required. I've probably said the same thing myself. Or worse.
You, Pauline? I grinned. Wielding knives and cursing?
My, how you've changed.
She laughed. Funny. I was just thinking the very same about you.
For better or worse?
You are who you needed to become, Leah. We've both changed out of necessity.
A wrinkle darkened her brow. She noticed my riding leathers beneath my cloak for the first time.
Going somewhere?
Now that the rain has let up, people will be in the streets again. I can pass unnoticed, and Bryn and Regan are surely back by now. I want to—
They won't be back yet.
The City of Sacraments is only a few days' ride, and dedicating a memorial stone doesn't take but a day. Bryn and Regan won't—
Leah, I think you misunderstood. They're going to more cities after that, and then on to the lesser kingdoms. Regan to Gitos and Bryn to Courtenay. They're on a diplomatic mission ordered by the Field Marshal.
What are you talking about? Princes don't go on diplomatic missions. They're soldiers.
I questioned it too, especially with your father ill. It doesn't follow protocol. But Bryn thought it was important, and your father approved it.
All the way to the Lesser Kingdoms? My heart plummeted. That could mean weeks of waiting that we couldn't afford. But I couldn't march into the conclave without them. I shook my head. A diplomatic mission. I knew how Bryn and Regan hated such things. I could picture Regan rolling his eyes. The only part he would like was riding in the open...
My throat tightened. They were asking a lot of questions, trying to get at the truth. Just like Walther had.
I'll discreetly nose around.
Which made them a liability.
What's wrong? Pauline asked. I grabbed the porch post to steady myself. A visit to a lesser kingdom would mean days of traveling across the Cam Lantau. They'd be unsuspecting and easy targets. My heart went cold. They weren't on a mission. They were headed into another ambush. The princes were being eliminated, along with their questions. My father would never have approved this, not if he knew. It's an ambush, Pauline. Bryn and Regan are headed into an ambush, the same as Walther. They have to be stopped before it's too late. I have to go tell my father. Now! And I ran for the citadel, praying it wasn't already too late.
Chapter 58, Caden.
Hello, Andreas. I had promised Leah I wouldn't confront my father. I'd said nothing about my brother. I'd heard Pauline wonder aloud to Gwyneth if it could have been Andreas who had followed her to the inn and alerted the Chancellor to where they were staying. Pauline hadn't revealed her identity to Andreas, but she recalled that he'd asked her a lot of questions. Once she learned what the Vice-Regent had done to me, it made her wonder if his questions hadn't been so innocent after all. I was sure they weren't innocent. He was his father's son. I surprised him at the cemetery gate just after he walked in, quickly hooking one arm over his shoulder like we were old friends, my other hand holding a knife discreetly pressed to his side. "Let's go for a walk, shall we?" He got the message right away and fell into step with me. I led him to Morrigan's crypt in the center of the cemetery, a place of cobwebs, spirits, dim light, and thick walls. Once we were down the stairs, I pushed him away. He stumbled forward and turned. His head angled to the side as he finally got a good look at me. The dawning came fast. I guessed that I looked far too much like our father. Andreas took after his mother, ashy coloring, a round cherub face, better suited to begging on street corners. But he wasn't the bastard son.
Caden?
I saw his fingers twitch as if to reach for his weapon.
I thought you were dead.
I think that was the point. It didn't turn out that way.
I know you have reason to be angry for what he did to you, Caden, but it's been years. Father has changed.
Sure he has. He glanced at my knife, still gripped at my side.
What do you want? He asked.
Answers, and maybe a bit of blood to pay for all that I've lost.
How did you know where to find me?
Marisol told me, I answered. He frowned.
You mean Pauline?
I figured you knew.
The belly threw me off, but her voice, I met her once. She didn't remember me.
I guess I didn't make much of an impression, but she made one on me.
Is she...
She won't be back, I said firmly, so he'd know that whatever sights he'd set on Pauline were a thing of the past. Tell me, Andreas, how is it that you were the only one who didn't ride with Prince Walther's platoon the one time they encountered a Venden brigade? His eyes narrowed.
I didn't ride because I was ill.
I don't recall you as the sickly sort. This happen often, or was it just a coincidence that staying home saved your neck?
What are you implying, brother? He sneered.
Do I really need to say it?
I was ill for a week, mostly delirious. The court physician can confirm it. When I came to, Father said I'd been sick with a fever.
You were with him when you fell ill?
Yes. I'd had dinner with him and a few cabinet members at his apartments the night before I was to ride out, but as I was leaving, I got dizzy and fell. Father's servants helped me to bed. I don't remember much after that. What difference does it make? No one knew what Walther and the others were headed into.
Sure, someone knew, and that someone didn't want his only remaining son going into a massacre that he had planned. I'm guessing the son was happy to play along. He drew his sword.
You're talking treason!
His eyes were wide and crazed, his voice desperate, and it occurred to me that he might actually be telling the truth. Pauline had said he was grieved by the platoon's death. If his grief wasn't real, why else would he come here to mourn every day? I studied him, wondering about some other kind of motivation, but I saw only anguish in his eyes, not deceit.
Put it away, Andreas. I'd rather not kill you.
He lowered his sword.
Who are you?
He asked, as if he sensed I was not just his little discarded brother anymore. No one you want to know, I told him.
Who else was there the night you fell ill? He thought for a moment, then said that, besides his father, he had also dined with the Chancellor, the watch captain, and the court physician.
Chapter 59.
My parents shared a marriage chamber, but there was a private suite next to the physician's office for royal family members when they were ill or in need of care. It was the chamber where my mother had given birth to us all. If my father was truly ill, and maybe even if it was a ruse, that was where he would be. I walked into the outer chamber, my hair tucked into a cap, and my face bowed into a stack of towels piled high in my arms. A flask dangled from my hand. I shuffled forward with indifference, while my feet burned to run. Even my father, no matter how angry with me, would still be raw with Walther's loss. A glimmer of doubt was all it would take for him to rescind his order. I'd make him listen if I had to hold a blade to his throat and take him hostage.
"I'm here to sponge the king with a tincture ordered by the physician," I said in a thick Gastineau brogue, sounding like my Aunt Burnett when she was angry. The sleepy nurse sitting in a chair by the door perked up.
"But no one—"
I know," I grumbled. I swallowed and forced my words out in an annoyed drawl. "No one ever tells us anything until the last minute. Here I was about ready to go home. Maybe I can talk you into doing this? If I were to—"
"No," she said, thinking the better of it. "I've been stuck here for hours. I could use the break." She glanced at the guard standing by the open door to the inner chamber.
"Need his help?"
"Pff, I ain't doing much more than his brow. Don't need help for that." She stood with relief and was out the door before I could say anything else. The inner chamber was dim. As I passed the guard, I asked him to close the door behind me since my arms were full. "Protocol," I chided when he hesitated. The door gently shut behind me, and I faced the large bed on the opposite wall. I almost didn't see my father in it. He was small and sunken, like he was being eaten up whole by pillows and blankets. His eye sockets were shadowed, and the skin thin over his cheekbones. He was someone I didn't know. I set the towels and flask on a table and stepped closer. He didn't stir. "He's dying. They are killing him." My pulse raced. The Citadel had already whispered this truth to me. I'd thought it meant everyone but him, not the man who had always been bluster and power, all that I had ever known. "Father?" "Nothing." I dropped to his side and took his hand in mine. It was limp and warm. What was wrong with him? I desperately wanted to see him loud and angry in all the ways that Walther had described him, the way he had always been, but not like this.
"Regina?"
I startled at his weak voice. His eyes remained closed. "No, Father. Mother is busy elsewhere. It's Arabella. You must try to listen to me. It's important that you order Bryn and Regan home immediately. Do you understand what I'm saying?" He frowned. His eyes slivered open.
"Arabella, you're late. And it's your wedding day. How will I explain it?"
My throat pinched. A misty fog filled his gaze. "I'm here now, Father." I lifted his hand to my cheek. "All will be well. I promise."
"Regina. Where is my Regina?"
His eyes drifted closed again. "My Regina." My mother's name was tender on his lips. Even my name had been spoken with tenderness. A gentle reprimand, not an angry one. "Father." But I knew it was no use. He couldn't issue an order for a drink of water,
much less make a demand for Bryn and Regan's safe return. He had already floated back to his unconscious world. I laid his hand on his chest and pressed my fingers to his neck. His pulse was firm and steady. If it wasn't a weak heart that had laid him low, what was it? I stood and went to the bureau, my fingers carelessly running through the mountain of tinctures, syrups, and balms, all remedies I recognized. My mother had given them to me and my brothers many times. I opened the bottles and sniffed. The scents brought back memories of stuffy heads and fevered brows. I rifled through a box of herbs and liniments, and then moved on to the bureau drawers. I didn't even know what I was looking for. An ointment? Liquid? Something that pointed to his true ailment? They are killing him. Or maybe they weren't treating a simple illness properly. I looked elsewhere in the room, searching behind a mirror, a pedestal that held a tall vase of flowers, in his bedside table, and even slid my hand beneath the mattress, but turned up nothing. I went to the door of the adjoining physician's office, pressing my ear to it. When I judged the room to be empty, I gently eased open the door and searched there, too, but short of tasting every elixir and waiting to see the effect, I had no way of knowing what may have caused my father's weak and confused state. Maybe it was his heart. Maybe I had broken it, just as the rumors said. I returned to his chamber, and my eyes lit on the box of herbs and liniments again. The physician had always disdained the cook's kitchen remedies. When Aunt Burnett made tea from rapsy blossoms for Aunt Cloris's headaches, he would shake his head and smirk. I searched through it again, more carefully this time. Beneath the other bottles, I found a small vial no bigger than my little finger. It was filled with a golden powder I'd never seen. An herb for the heart the nurse was neglecting to give him? I pulled the cork from the vial, but could detect no herbal scent, and began to lift it closer to my nose. No, don't. I held it at arm's length, examining the shimmering gold, then replaced the cork and set it back with the others, shutting the lid.
Your Highness!
I spun. The Chancellor stood there in all his glory, his crimson robes flowing, his knuckles glittering, his arrogant, tight-lipped smile beaming with triumph. Two guards with drawn swords stood behind him.
How amusing that your note said I should be afraid, he said, his tone cheerful. I think, my dear, it is you who should be afraid.
I glared at him. Don't be so sure. I shrugged off my cloak so my weapons were easier to draw and looked past him to the guards. I didn't recognize them. Had he changed the guard who kept the citadel secure? Still, they wore the royal guard insignia.
Lay your weapons down, I told them. By all that is holy, do not defend this man. He's a traitor who's sending my brothers into an ambush. Please. Really, Princess, the Chancellor said, shaking his head. I thought groveling was beneath you. We all know who the real traitor is. You're a declared enemy of the realm. Your blood runs so cold that you killed your own brother.
I did not kill him. I
seize her,
the Chancellor said, stepping aside. The guards came at me, but instead of running away, I lunged forward, and in a blurred second, one of my arms had hooked the Chancellor's neck, while the other held a knife to his throat.
Get back, I ordered.
The guards paused, swords ready to strike, but they didn't retreat.
Step back, you fools,
the Chancellor yelled, feeling the sting of my knife pressing into his flesh. They backed up cautiously, stopping against the opposite wall.
That's better, I said,
then whispered in the Chancellor's ear. Now, what were you saying about being afraid? Though I loved the feel of his racing heart beneath my arm, I heard footsteps pounding down the hallway toward us.
More guards had already been alerted, and I probably had only seconds before all my exits would be blocked. I pulled him back with me toward the physician's door, and when it was only a step behind me, I shoved him so he stumbled forward. I slipped inside the room, barring the door behind me. In seconds, the guards were ramming against it, and I heard the Chancellor screaming on the other side to break it down. I went to the window and threw open the shutter, but there was no ledge for escape. I looked down to a balcony directly beneath the window. It was a 20-foot drop onto hard stone, but I couldn't see any other option. I eased myself out, hanging from the window by my fingertips, then let go. I rolled with the fall, but the impact still sent splitting pain up my leg. I fled, limping as I ran, my route now a wild and haphazard one, darting into rooms, hallways, redirecting my steps when I heard the pounding of footsteps in pursuit. I raced down a dark servant's stairway, and then an empty hall, the shouts getting weaker, their search still confined to the upper floors. I was at the back of the citadel, heading down a long, dark passage for the rarely used servant's entrance that Pauline and I had escaped through. I had just slid the latch open when I heard a metallic chink, and I spun toward the sound. A strange keening whir filled the air, and then a loud thunk, thunk, thunk. A hot jolt exploded in my arm. My vision flashed with pain so bright I couldn't focus. When I tried to pull away, my breaths shuddered in my chest. I couldn't move. I looked to my left. Two long iron bolts were embedded high in the door, but a third had pinned my hand to the wood, piercing the center of my palm. Blood dripped to the floor. I heard footsteps and tried frantically to pull the bolt loose, but the least movement sent sickening pain convulsing through me. The footsteps grew louder, closer. I looked up and saw the silhouette of a figure walking leisurely toward me. I recognized the swagger. My knife lay on the floor at my feet. I drew my sword, a pathetic gesture, because I knew I couldn't fight with one hand pinned to the door. His face came into view. Malik. A crossbow unlike any I had ever seen dangled from one of his hands. I trembled with pain as he drew closer. Every sound was amplified, his footsteps, the tip of my sword scraping the floor, my own breath wheezing in my throat.
"So nice to run into you, princess," he said. "I understand Caden is here, too. I never should have let him slip away from me that day when we fought on the terrace."
The smug grin, the one I'd sworn he would pay for. "I wish I could say it was nice to see you too, Malik." I lifted my sword as a threat, but even that small movement magnified the painful stab in my hand. I tried to mask my agony. He easily knocked my sword away with his crossbow, sending it clattering across the room. The jerking twist of my body sent blinding jolts shooting up my arm, and I couldn't restrain a scream. He grabbed my free hand and pressed his body against mine. "Please," I said. "My brothers..."
"Just the way I prefer you, princess. Begging and with both of your hands restrained."
His face still bore the lines of my attack, and his eyes glowed with vengeance. He leaned closer, and his free hand circled my throat.
"The bolts are courtesy of the Commissar. He's sorry he couldn't be here to deliver them himself. Sadly, you must settle for me."
His hand slid from my throat to my breast.
"And after I'm finished with you, I'll carve up your face with marks like the ones you gave me. He doesn't care what you look like when I hand you over."
His grin widened, and that was all I could see, all I could feel, the assured expression that said he owned the world. It was a grin that churned memories to the surface. I saw my brother weeping. I saw the arrow in Greta's throat. I saw a baby's lace cap burning and curling into ash.
"That was easy," he had boasted.
Killing her was easy. His breaths were heavy in my ear as his hand slid lower, fumbling with my belt, jerking at the buttons of my trousers. Easy. I felt the crunch of bone as I forced my pinned hand to twist, turn, grab hold of the bolt. Blood rushed down my arm. Groans shuddered up from my throat like animal sounds, thick and wild. I used the pain the way a fire consumes fuel, burning hotter and hotter, and with my hand gripped around the bolt, I forced my arm to shove against it, loosening it. My fingers burned like they'd been set ablaze, the iron bolt becoming rage in my hand, and I pulled, loosening it further, my groans only adding to Malik's satisfaction. His eyes gleamed, looking into mine as if he already knew where he would carve the lines. Easy.
No fainting on me now, princess, he said as he jerked the last button of my trousers free.
His hand slid beneath the leather, down along my hip, his grin widening.
I keep my promises, and I told the Komazar that you would suffer.
I yanked on the bolt, twisting it as it sprang free, the sudden release adding velocity to my swing, and it plunged into Malik's neck, the pointed end emerging through the other side. His eyes widened.
And I keep my promises, too, I said.
His lips parted as if to say something. He was unable to speak, but I saw it in his eyes. For a few glorious seconds, he knew. He was a dead man, and it was by my hand. While he could still hear me, I whispered, I hate that it feels so good and so easy to kill you, Malik. Rest assured, I will never beg you for anything ever again. I pulled the bolt free, and blood spurted from his neck before he thudded to the ground. Dead. I stared at his crumpled body, the blood running slowly from his neck, trickling into lazy red rivers across the cobbled floor. His eyes stared blankly at the ceiling. His grin was gone. It was then that a thunder of footsteps closed in from all sides. 6 guards surrounded me, again ones I didn't recognize. The watch captain stood among them. He was the member of the cabinet who oversaw the Citadel guards. He looked down at Malik's body with recognition and shook his head. A nauseous wave rushed through me.
Not you two, I said.
I'm afraid so.
Captain, don't do this, I pleaded.
Believe me, princess, if I could reverse time, I would. But I'm in much too deep to turn back now.
It's not too late. You could still save my brothers. You could...
Take her.
I stepped forward and swung, the bolt still in my hand, but my knees gave way and I hit the floor. 2 guards scooped me up by my arms, and another pulled the bolt free. Blood spurted, and my head swam as they dragged me. I tried to keep track of where they were taking me, but all I saw were blurred shapes swirling in front of me. Stop the bleeding, Leah. But with their hands clamped on my arms... There was no chance of that. Instead, I pleaded to their loyalties, trying to convince them that the watch captain was the vilest of traitors. Even my words seemed slurred, distant, and one of the guards repeatedly told me to shut up, but I didn't stop. He finally cracked me in the jaw. The soft flesh on the inside of my cheek sliced into my teeth, and the salty tang of blood filled my mouth. The passageway faded in and out, and floor and ceiling spun into each other. But it was a word a guard muttered just before he threw me into a dark room that slammed into me harder than his fist.
Jabave.
There was a reason I hadn't recognized the Citadel guards. They were Venden.
Chapter 60.
Just a little farther, Leah. Hold on. Hold on for me. I smelled a river, glimpsed the weighty, bowed pines of a forest, saw frosty breaths swirling the air above me, and heard the steady, determined beat of boots crunching in snow. I felt warm lips brushing mine. Just a little farther. For me. My eyes drifted open. I wasn't dead yet. The snowy world, the blinding whiteness, and the scent of pine vanished. Instead, I was in a black, windowless room. But I still felt the arms that had held me, the fingers that had brushed back strands of my hair, the chest that had been a warm wall against the cold, and I heard the voice that wouldn't let me go. Keep your eyes on me. The fiery blue that had demanded I stay. I tried to focus, search the blackness. The cell was stuffy, the air as old as the walls themselves. It smelled of dirt and rot. I pulled my hand close to my stomach, pressing it tight to stop the bleeding, but the pressure sent a blinding stab through me. I sucked in air, forcing my lungs to breathe. I couldn't accept that it was over, that there would be no word sent to save my brothers, that the traitors wouldn't be exposed, that the Komazar had won. Seeing Malik dead was suddenly a very small victory. The satisfaction trickled away, like his blood across the floor. His death only gave me an ending. It didn't give back what had been taken. The path here was a blur and I wasn't sure where I was, but it wasn't the Citadel. Maybe one of the outbuildings? Why would they chance dragging me out in the open when the Citadel prison had been only steps away? I didn't think they had taken me as far as Pierre's camp, but I couldn't be sure. I tried to stand to search the room for something to use as a weapon, but my injured leg buckled under me, and my face slammed into the dirt floor. I lay there like a wounded animal. Do we understand each other at last? I choked back angry tears. No. I pushed with my one good hand, trying to get up. I thought the situation couldn't get any worse, but I was wrong. I heard footsteps, muffled shouts, and squinted against the sudden bright light as the door swung open. More prisoners were flung inside. The door slammed, and the room plunged back into darkness.
He is near my children. His lips brush my neck. His spittle wets my cheek. His caress crushes my breaths. More than swords, more than fists, my words frighten him. I see my end. But the words I have given you, I pray, those he cannot take. Song of Venda. Chapter 61, Rafe.
Only a few of us rode through the woods. The rest remained in town, dispersed so as not to attract attention, but ready. As we got closer to the cottage, I put my hand up, a wordless order for everyone to stop. They heard it too. An angry squalling. A cat, perhaps, or... We broke into a gallop. As we neared, I spotted Caden running from the woods toward the cottage. He saw us, but kept running. "Pauline! Leah!" he yelled as he ran. We piled through the cottage door, only to find it empty, except for the howl of a baby. We all looked at the bed at the same time, and Caden bent down, pulling a bundle from beneath it. "It's Pauline's," he said as he cradled the baby in his arms. He pulled aside the blanket to make sure it wasn't hurt. "She would never leave her baby like this." And then, as if he'd finally registered our presence, he asked, "What the hell are you doing here?" Before I could answer, Birdie and a young girl burst through the door. Birdie yelled warnings and threats before finally demanding the baby be handed over. It was pandemonium and confusion as questions were hurled until Oren rushed in and said there were fresh horse tracks outside that weren't ours. "Someone took them," Caden said. "She hid the baby beneath the bed so they wouldn't take him too." The girl with Birdie darted for the door. I have to get to the Abbey. Both Caden and Birdie yelled for her to stop, but she was already gone. I got on my horse and ran her down, unsure of her motives. She drew a knife to hold me off. That